Hello everyone, thank you for downloading the Best of the Indian Startup Show, Part 4. So today you will hear from Vamsi Krishna. He's the co-founder and CEO of Vedantu. They are based in Bangalore. Vedantu are a live online tutoring platform that aims to personalize and democratize learning in India. Next up, I speak to Neha Motwani. She's the founder and CEO of Fraternity. Fraternity is a discovery platform for workout classes and other fitness services based in Mumbai. The platform allows users to book free trials with exercise classes, personal trainers, and nutritionists. Next up is Vishal Shah. He's the founder and CEO of Hot Chef. Hot Chef is a unique meal kit concept. They send a box of pre-measured label ingredients along with easy to follow step-by-step instructions and putting together a truly gourmet dish in your home kitchen. And finally, I chat to Anubhav Pada. He's the founder and CEO of ShopHop. ShopHop is an e-commerce platform which serves as a curated marketplace for natural, artisanal, homegrown foods and wellness products. So sit back and enjoy some of the best bits of the Indian Startup Show. Thank you.
So I'm Vamsi, one of the co-founders and CEO of Vedantu. Along with me, I started this company with three friends of mine. So we are four guys who started this up. Vedantu is the second educational venture of ours. Even before this, the four of us, we started our first educational venture way back in 2006. This was right after our college. Myself and my other three friends, we are all from IITs. After that, we did some quick 5-6 months of job. It was not working great for us. So, you know, just thought of, you know, coming into education and start teaching kids. Yeah. So that's how this whole journey in education began. So we started actually teaching kids from in a rural place in India. And it was pretty satisfying. And
so was this an offline thing?
Exactly. Yeah. Completely offline. Completely offline. It was a brick and mortar setup. The other two guys were working in some place. It was a sulfuric processing plant. And we had workers, their kids who were aspiring for some engineering colleges in their 11th grade and 12th grade. So we just started off by teaching them. And it was, I think, I would say, a most satisfying experience teaching those kids. And I think, Neil, that's what finally, you know, led us to, you know, a journey in Vedantu. So this entire journey was very important for shaping of what Vedantu is today. So in nutshell, what we are doing at Vedantu is that Vedantu is an online tutoring platform, right? In which we have a lot of teachers who are listed on the platform and a lot of students on this side. It operates like any marketplace out there in which a student would come and put his requirement. According to that requirement, we'll show him a list of teachers. All these teachers would have their different prizes, qualifications, experience, rating, review. Basis these things, you will select a teacher. And the whole system, the tech part comes here, that we enable a live interaction between these two guys. Like, for example, like Skype we are doing right now. So imagine it's something like a Skype, but custom made for education, right? In which you can not just talk to each other and see each other in real time, but also you can write and, you know, interact through writing with each other in real time.
Excellent.
So it's whiteboard and audio and video communication all in real time basis.
How long did it take you to build this?
So Neil, the team has been at it for almost like close to 1.5 years now. Okay. So yeah, it took a substantial amount of like almost before launch, we, you know, we devoted almost eight months of time creating the basic framework.
Excellent. Right? And in terms of stats, then how many students have used this platform, for example?
Yeah, sure. So we launched Vedantu to the public in November 2014. So it's just over a year now, right? And in this time, we, so Vedantu, as I said before that, I'll tell you where we focus on. So our focus is majorly on the 6th grade to 10th grade and only maths and science.
Right, maths and science.
So currently, we have not added a lot of other categories. We are just concentrated on maths and science. And the major focus is in India as a country, okay? So we are not going out aggressively and probably, you know, pitching it for external students. So in the last few months, we have had more than 60,000 hours of live tutoring on the platform.
Okay.
This has happened from over 250 cities in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We have, in terms of students, we have a registered base of around close to, I think, 28,000 students.
Okay.
Okay. And out of that, probably more than 3,000 would be our monthly active subscribers.
Yeah.
Okay. So when I say monthly active subscribers, imagine them as probably students who are coming on the platform and probably engaging with the teacher almost for 8 to 9 hours in a month.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Cool. Excellent. So how big is the tutoring market in India now?
Oh, Neil, it's pretty big. It's very, very big. So there are, just to give you a sense, there are 300 million kids in K-12 in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And out of that, 33% of them go for private schools.
Okay.
Okay. So it's almost close to 80 million. Okay.
Yeah.
Which is slated to become 100 million by 2020. All of them go for private tutoring.
Right.
I'm even discounting the other, 60-odd% from public schools. I'm assuming they don't go for private tutoring. Mm-hmm. Some of them also go, right? So the number is almost like 80 to 100 million kids, mm-hmm, who actually go for a parallel tutoring apart from their schools, right? Mm-hmm. Right, it starts right from second to third grade and extends all the way to 12th grade.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
And at an average, these parents, so you need to understand that, the parents in India, and it's not just an India phenomena, but mm-hmm, more from a Southeast Asia phenomena,
mm-hmm,
right? They are extremely sensitive to, quality education, and they really see it as a means for a better lifestyle and living.
Okay.
Right? So the per capita spend on education is very, very high, mm-hmm, in the country. These kids for parallel education spend almost close to 25 to 30,000 Indian rupees, mm-hmm, per annum average.
Okay. So let's talk about education then. We have a lot of students listening to the show. What advice would you give them going into higher education?
I think understanding yourself and your passion is the most important thing, right? I really believe that if a student is able to understand what he really likes and loves, irrespective of what that field is, I've always noticed that these kids actually turn out and do great in their chosen field of profession. So the early part of the life should actually be spent on exploring, mm-hmm, more. And more, right? How much you can. And trying to judge a sense or trying to get a sense of where is the liking for. Mm-hmm. Okay. It, I think, is a process which is a constant work in progress kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. Okay. In multiple cases, some of the students I have interacted and seen.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, in my experience at Laksh, all our founders, we have taught and mentored more than 10,000 students just between us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In that experience, I can say that some of the kids I have seen understand their passion and their liking for a particular topic or field of interest as early as in 10th grade.
Mm-hmm.
For some, it's a discovery and it happens probably in their second year or third year of education in their colleges. Okay. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really matter where you find that. I think the exploration should happen. And once you find, then I think, you know it inside. Then there is nothing which stops you. And once you pursue that, mm-hmm, you really do great in that chosen field of profession.
Excellent. Let's talk about the startup then. What excites you most about doing this startup?
So as I said, the whole entry into the startup was a little accidental for us. When we were doing this teaching for the kids way back in 2006, we really never thought of it as a startup.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But probably now 11 years into this whole startup thing, what I can actually, a simple answer which I can give to this question is, as an entrepreneur, you always see a lot of things around you. As a human being, you see a lot of things around you. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing which actually, makes startups and more importantly, entrepreneurs, stand out is the fact that one of the problems they will see, and an entrepreneur will feel very strongly about their problem statement,
mm-hmm,
and also feel that he has an elegant solution around that problem, which really solves the nails that problem out. And then the passion for that problem solving and that solution is so high that an entrepreneur really cannot think of anything else apart from that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's, in my humble opinion, is when I feel a true startup or a true, entrepreneur is born.
Mm-hmm.
When you really strongly feel about a problem statement.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think that stands out for me in my entire journey of this entrepreneurship and doing a startup. What has really got me going and my fellow mates going is the fact that, we are actually trying to not just create a business that can never be the motive. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
the thing which actually gets us going is that, you know, there is a bigger vision and there's a bigger problem which we're trying to solve. And I think that is what really gets you going.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So that stands out for me in my experience of working in a startup.
Excellent. You mentioned vision. What is the vision of the company?
If you look at the entire education system in the world, okay, for decades, in fact, there are two essential problems which plagues it. Okay, and this is truly a teacher in me speaking. If you look at all the technology which has happened, okay, and if you look at a classroom today, you can second me on, you will second me on this, that, you know, the technology currently has not penetrated the classroom. Now, whenever there are attempts on edtechs, you know, a lot of people, you know, attack it in a way that, you know, we need to use technology in a classroom. That's not an end to itself. Technology cannot and should not be used just for the sake of using it. Just because you have a tool or a new tech, it's not that, that, you know, education has to be, you know, it has to be incorporated into the education system. Yeah. My hypothesis here is, if you look at the entire system, unfortunately, the whole world is drifting more and more towards generalization, mm-hmm. whereas I think it should be more towards personalization.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the entire revolution, the latest revolutions in edtech, for example, the MOOCs, you know, of the world mm-hmm. and all, is further drifting and making it drift towards generalization.
Mm-hmm.
Wherein earlier, when I used to say that a teacher teaching a class of 50 is not optimized, now you have a system wherein you're saying one video will cater to billions of kids.
Mm-hmm.
Although there have been beautiful attempts at solving the problem of accessibility,
mm-hmm.
but I think it has to be context-driven and also age-driven. The target in which we are trying to solve this, especially the junior grades, which is the K1 to K10,
mm-hmm.
I think the context is very important. And here, you know, the accessibility, more than accessibility, the issue is of personalization. So that is one very big vision on which, you know, Vedanta is built on, and we are trying to solve this. Mm-hmm. That we are trying to use technology to solve and make education as personalized as possible.
Mm-hmm.
One is that. The second and equally big problem, Neil, is we all have been through education systems. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Not just India, but in the entire world. If you look at the education system, it's all institutionalized.
Yeah.
Okay. And institutionalization has its problems. It not just tries to control the students, but it also tries to control the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
If, for example, in 11th grade, if there is a topic on Newton's laws, the institute tries to determine that Newton's laws will be done in 5 lectures.
Mm-hmm.
And that is it. Okay. No matter how creative the teacher is. Okay. And probably no matter the teacher comes back and says that, you know what, probably my group requires 5 more lectures. You know, in very few percentage cases, those is allowed. Rest of all the cases, it's all standardized out there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Not just from the students' end, it's for the teachers' end as well. The teachers are not allowed to, you know, dictate a lot of things. Even their salaries and payments are, you know, standardized. This is not the most optimized system. In Vedantu, we really want to challenge this. Okay, we really believe and we have proved it that instead of institutes trying to control this interaction, they should actually step back and, you know, let the democracy clearly take care of the quality itself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So democratization is the second big challenge, mm-hmm. you know, facing the education institutes, and we really want to make it more democratized.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. When I say democratized, you know, think of what we are trying to do here at Vedantu. We don't dictate what a teacher should teach, how many lectures he should take to teach that, what content has to be given, okay, or probably what price he has to set, or what time he will teach, okay, or where he will teach from. We take a step back and let the rating and reviews decide for itself.
Mm-hmm.
We really believe that once this democracy takes care of itself. Sorry, the democracy is actually prevalent out there, and the quality is put out there in front of everyone.
Mm-hmm.
This whole interaction and the quality and the rating review will automatically force the teacher to get the best out of himself. Okay. And this is true democratization.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone can become a teacher here. Okay. Yes. It's not just the professional teachers who can become a teacher, but actually mm-hmm. anyone who is able to deliver the knowledge to the context of the child can become great teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, we solve the problem of the accessibility of teachers by creating more teachers.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Let's just talk about funding then. I believe you raised 5 million after 6 months of launching. Is that correct?
That's correct. But, you know, that's what happens, right? So typically, this is from an externally, we launched to the public in November, and, you know, we got the funding in the month of March, April. But to give you a sense of really what's happening behind, to get us to this idea of Vedantu, for external people, it may seem 6 months, but actually it took 10 years for us to go there. So some of this, so Axel, for example, was an investor who was in touch with us for multiple years, right? We were in discussing with them what we are doing, right? And that's actually that all the interaction and, you know, that time went about in getting this final accumulation into a funding.
Most companies don't get funding, but you did. Why do you think that is?
Okay, now, not just talking from education, but in general from a startup perspective, right? So funding, yes, not all companies get funding. Probably for the reason that not all companies need funding. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's one very big thing which needs to be, you know, which needs to be understood clearly, that not all companies and not all business models are venture fundable, if I can use that word, right? Like, for example, Neil, the previous company which we were doing, Laksh, right, was never venture fundable, right? Because the business model doesn't support this. So it was a completely bootstrapped business which we did. Organically, we made it up for like almost like 6 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if we go to a VC and ask for a funding for that kind of a business, they won't do that, because what a VC typically looks at is disproportionate scale and an ability to get disproportionate returns. Mm-hmm. That's what they make their money on. Yeah. So typically there are three parameters, okay, yeah, which is very important for a company to get venture funding.
Yeah.
Okay. Those three parameters in that order probably would be, the first and the foremost would be a team.
Yeah.
Right. The team has to be there, especially for early fundings, right? 80% of the decision is based on the team, in my opinion. The second is there has to be a very big market for, you know, the problem you're trying to solve. Mm-hmm. Very big market, right? And the third and equally important would be a proof of concept. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Yeah. Especially for early stage, there has to be a proof of concept that whatever problem you are proposing, there are enough people who care for that problem and who are ready to pay for that problem. Mm-hmm. Right. So, yeah. So these are the things which are necessary. And those companies which actually qualify on this, I don't think they have much issues in raising the fund.
Excellent. Look, one last question on funding then. I'm interested to know how much time you spent fundraising as opposed to working on your business.
In our case, I think we would not be a right example to take in this case, because in our case, as I was saying, we were in touch with one of the ventures for a long time, right? So for us, really, the fundraising process took very less time. It took 1.5 months for us, right? But again, from a general perspective, I think any entrepreneur or a startup guy should be looking at a 4 month to a 5 month scenario on an average for this fundraise process to take from the start to the end, right? A word of caution though, this process takes a lot of energy, sucks a lot of energy from the founders. Mm-hmm. And especially in early stage, founder's time is the most precious, right? If you're not giving time to your company, the growth will stall and there will be other issues, right? So I really would advise fellow entrepreneurs, especially at early stage, the seed stage and the Series A stage, to really optimize that. You should either be in a fundraise process or you should not be in a fundraise process, mm-hmm. right? And if you're in a fundraise process, it's almost like a switch on-off button. You should just turn it on and try to get over with this process as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. Because the time spent on business is most critical.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. What's your thoughts on hiring? Do you go for like all-round players or do you go for specialist skills?
So Neil, it really depends on the stage in which the company is in, mm-hmm. right? So it's temporal. It really depends on which stage are you hiring for in your company. Mm-hmm. So especially for a startup, if it's very early, like very early as in the founders, and then you're looking for your this next 4 or 5 guys, mm-hmm. right? I think it has to be, first of all, it has to be rock stars, and this rock stars has to be multifaceted. Mm-hmm. So you need to have people who are like jack of all trades.
Yep.
Okay. And of course, I mean, needless to say, enthusiastic about the vision and the problem statement, all those goes without saying, mm-hmm. right? But you really require people who can hustle up. They don't think a lot about process systems, who just hustle up and probably just execute it. The move fast, break fast approach, mm-hmm. right? No, but this approach doesn't get you far, okay? This may probably get you down to 6 months to 1 year. Mm-hmm. But as and when the team size grows from probably that 5, 6 to like 15, 20, mm-hmm. that is a stage. And typically, this is like the Series A kind of a stage, mm-hmm. right? That is when you then start to think about, you know, having people who have an experience of also trying to manage and start having some process systems, mm-hmm. okay? I'm not talking about big processes again here, like some processes and systems, because as the company grows in size, the communication becomes a problem, mm-hmm. right? A challenge, in fact. So you need people who can balance this stuff up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah. And then after that, definitely then, you know, you have a lot of case studies out there mm-hmm. that to have really great guys who are expert in their stuff. You need not have, you know, all rounders. You just have need to have people who are experts mm-hmm. in what they do and have experience in scaling and probably managing a bigger companies, like which is 100 member or a 500 member mm-hmm. companies.
Good stuff. You mentioned challenges before. What challenges have you had to face over the last 6 months?
So Vedantu, the challenge, specifically talking about Vedantu, the challenges apart from the standard ones like hiring is always a challenge for a startup, right? Mm-hmm. Apart from the challenges of hiring, from a business perspective, a very big challenge we are facing, we face and we are currently facing also is of category creation. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Vedantu is into online tutoring and, you know, not just in India, but globally, it's a new category. Mm-hmm. When you imagine education, you always imagine a teacher in, you know, in flesh and blood and, you know, mm-hmm. out there using a whiteboard or a blackboard and teaching, right? So that mindset is there for decades and decades. Mm-hmm. So in order to change that mindset, it takes time. It's almost like the early days of e-commerce when you told a person that, you know, you can buy shoes online or probably clothes online. It's not intuitive, right? It takes time for that to, you know, come in. So that's a similar challenge we are facing, that the category creation, it has its own set of associated challenges. We really need to create that trust. Okay. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so those are the one of the core challenges Vedantu faces.
Mm-hmm. Last few questions then. Who do you admire in the tech space or education space? Do you have any heroes?
I would not specifically talk about the education space, mm-hmm. But I would definitely would want to talk about the entire tech and the startup ecosystem, right?
Yeah.
I really admire the stuff, you know, Google does as a technology company, mm-hmm. right? I think they have constantly and consistently, I mean, over a decade, more than that, have set the bar for being a pure tech company. And that really is inspiring because, you know, you have a company out there which it really pushes the envelope, right? So from a tech perspective, I really admire that company. Mm-hmm. From a perspective of innovative products, we have to admire Apple, mm-hmm. of course. But more importantly, recently Tesla. So, you know, Elon Musk, really admire that guy mm-hmm. for the sheer vision he has. Right. So when the whole world is talking about smaller problems, this guy comes out and says that, you know what, the bigger problem we need to solve is that, you know, Earth will get extinct in some time. Mm-hmm. So we need to find an alternate home, you know, and that is truly inspiring. You know, I mean, that gives you a completely different perspective out there. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think, yeah, at some point of time, you need such people to push the human race forward. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yes, these are some of the things I admire.
Excellent. What books or blogs do you read? Anything you can recommend?
Oh, definitely. So I think as a CEO and more importantly, as any entrepreneur, you should constantly be in a learning phase. That's very, very important. I would really want to stress an emphasis on that because, you know, the startup itself is so dynamic. There is no one size fits all advice. Mm-hmm. Okay. You really need to understand at which stage you are in. And accordingly, you need to seek advice. Okay. The advice can either come from, you know, a mentor, which is very important. You should really be in touch with mentors, founders of startup who have been there, done that. Mm-hmm. Right. That is a very, very, very important thing. In fact, mm-hmm. the second thing is on a personal note, some of the books I really found great is, okay. So there are a list of them. Mm-hmm. I'll just, tell a few.
Yeah, go.
So one of the things which I really loved about is for early, the very early stage, which is I'm saying the conceptualization stage startups. Okay.
Yeah.
A must read for them is definitely a lean startup, mm-hmm. right? So lean startup clearly lays the framework out that how should you reduce time and still go out and validate your hypothesis and product. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think it's almost should be a must read thing for, you know, any early stage guy who is just with an idea and is going out there. Mm-hmm. Okay. Will save a lot of time, believe me. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's one. The second one, of course, as you scale up, some of the stuff you need to really understand and execute on is growth, mm-hmm. right? So I think, you know, the standard stuff is somewhere around growth. There are a lot of stuff written on growth. Okay. So growth hacks, right? So some of the things around growth and how do you basically get growth. These are the things which there are a lot of blogs on this. Mm-hmm. You should go out there and read.
Yeah.
Paul Graham's blog is super awesome. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Paul Graham's blog is something which I constantly read. And because it's blog, there are a lot of blogs written for different contexts, mm-hmm. right? I think you should read that. Now, from a present perspective, like for example, right now, what I'm really loving to read is Ben Howard's Hard Things About Hard mm-hmm. Things, right? I think it's a wonderful read. I think it's a must read for any startup CEO, mm-hmm. okay? Especially at an early stage, a series A, series B stage. Mm-hmm. Okay. Completely lays the framework out on how a CEO should conduct himself. When company is typically of a size of 100 to 500 employees, what are the challenges and how should actually go about solving that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So these are some of the stuff I really recommend people reading.
You mentioned mentors before. Who mentors you then?
A lot of guys, Neil, actually. Okay. So, for example, just to take few names over here in India, especially. So Raghu is a guy who really, I consider as a close mentor. He's the one who has been a CEO co-founder of Taxi for Sure, okay. which got acquired by Ola, right? Yeah. So he's the one who, who's actually been there, done that. So a lot of mentorship advice comes from him, right? Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of one actually, they're quite a few. I won't be able to take names of all, but yeah. Yeah, it's a stance.
Being a former teacher, do you have any tips on revising?
Interesting. So, it's a long time back, so I'm just trying to recollect. Okay, so one of the things which we do is we always try to refer to a new thing for revising. Okay. Mm-hmm. Not all of us, some of us do. So if you're done with a chapter or probably a year's material, you then try to find a new material and then, think that, okay, fine, I'll solve this and I'll use it as a revision. Mm-hmm. In my experience, that really doesn't work out great. Okay. You should always, especially for the kids, right, in K-10 and below, when the exams are approaching, right, for example, these times it's exam days, you should always try to refer your previous material, mm-hmm. okay, while revising. That's very important and it's really effective, actually. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the second thing is, especially for competitive exams, the best revision is actually by taking lots of practice tests. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, these two things really works great.
Excellent. What's the best advice you've ever received?
Okay, not from a startup perspective, but more from, before startup. So taking that plunge perspective, mm-hmm. okay? I would say there are a lot of advices since after I started a startup, which I received from mentors. So I really will not be able to take one best advice out of mm-hmm. them, okay? But definitely I recollect one advice which I received before I was thinking of starting this mm-hmm. up, okay? And that I think was very, very important because that really set the tone for everything else which followed, mm-hmm. okay? So I was in two minds whether I should, take that plunge or not, mm-hmm. okay? And what is the right time? Is it the right time? And all those things which, typically a person does, mm-hmm. okay? So the mentorship I received, the advice I received is, that old Nike slogan, right? which is, just do it. Okay. So the advice was that just don't think about it. Don't over-calculate. Don't apply your MBA brain on it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Just do it. Mm-hmm. So I think this is the best advice which I can also give and extend to all the startup founders and probably even those guys who are thinking and contemplating of a startup. Mm-hmm. Just, don't overthink. Mm-hmm. Follow the Nike slogan. Just do it.
Just do it. Hello, Neha. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Pleasure, Neil.
Awesome. Tell me a little bit about yourself and what you're building, please.
Yeah, so we're building, something interesting in the fitness space. It's called Fiternity, Fiternity. We're on web and on mobile. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do is basically create an ecosystem and be an enabler for all things fitness. And we've just started targeting at the base of the user need gap, which is discovery. Mm-hmm. Moving on to booking and then looking at purchase and engagement and motivation.
Excellent.
So really trying to get users to get started on their fitness journey, get them activated, have them stick to it mm-hmm. and do it in India. So yeah.
How did you start this? Can you remember the conversation that you had to get this going?
Yeah, so I think it's very interesting and I never really thought that I will do this. Mm-hmm. My job as a consultant just involved a lot of traveling, within the country, outside of country. And I've always been, a fitness enthusiast, of grand marathons, done CrossFit. But I think along the line, it became really difficult to stick to the fitness journey, right? And whenever I would be back to India and I would be like, okay, it's not my motivation. Something is wrong here, right? What is it? And I think it started with just saying that, how can I discover more things to do apart from gym, a local gym around my house. And that really got me thinking, and I realized that there's no one actually helping you do that, right? Mm-hmm. There are so many restaurant discovery apps, there's those couponing apps, there's everything happening to make you feel happy, fit, fine, happy, and sort of, is helping you plan your travel, is helping you eat out, but no one's really helping you get fit, at least in the Indian ecosystem with that kind of focus. And, I started looking at both the consumer side of the story as well as the supply side, right, which is the gyms and studios. And I realized that the supply side is actually facing a major concern on how to get consumers, how to attract the right guys, how to get more footfalls. So really build it out from that side, and really looked at a lot of consumer surveys, vendor side of surveys, realized that there's a need gap. There's no one doing this. So I'm talking about this about, 2 years back, in 2014, right? Build a product which said that, okay, let's do a very, very quick beta version of the product where we do discovery, and let's see how it goes. And we got a tremendous response from users on day one. And that's when we actually built it out. I quit my job and then started.
How long have you been doing this now?
So we actually launched the beta version of the website, like I said, in early 2014. It took us about 6 months to get the product right. So it's been, it's been about a year and a half that, Fraternity exists the way it is currently.
Excellent. Actually, you mentioned that you were doing it for a year and a half now. Can you share any stats? I mean, how many people have used the platform, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, sure. So, we see about 200,000 unique visitors, monthly on the website. And that number has been growing at about 30%, every month. About 65,000 consumers so far have, started their fitness journey through Fraternity, which is, either they've actually booked a trial through the website, or they've bought a membership, and which is fairly great, because what we are actually trying to do is we're trying to get people started on their fitness journey. So as a user, you can book unlimited trials till you figure out what you're looking for, and that's for us a very, very important point in terms of the fitness journey, which we then focus on engagement in terms of, if Neil booked a trial, we're going to give Neil all the details in terms of what to expect from the yoga class, what to carry, when to go there, how much calories is he going to burn, ensure that he has a Google pin, he knows who he's meeting, he experiences something, what we call a VIP trial, which is only available through Fraternity, and then there is a high chance of him converting.
Excellent.
Yes.
Cool. So you said you got 200,000 people going to the website. I mean, how do you attract customers to the website in terms of marketing? Is it SEO? Is it email? Social media? Which is the best channel for you, do you think?
Yeah, so we use a combination of all what you said. The strongest one that's always worked for us has been SEO.
Okay.
We've really focused on SEO, and I think by far, even today when we look at the funnel in terms of, user to search, search to trial booking to purchase, we've seen that funnel very tight with an organic user sort of coming from search.
Excellent.
The team is now about 45 people across, spread across four, geographies in four cities. So Mumbai, Delhi, Bangalore, and Pune.
And what's it like being a CEO?
I think it's very exciting, definitely, but very different from a corporate job, because, the CEO's life is, the buck stops at you, and people look up to you, and there's a lot more happening in the day than just getting work done. There's future rounds of funding, there are strategic partnerships, there's where you want to take your business, your product. So I think crazy, challenging, but awesome fun too.
And what's been the fun thing then? What's been the most exciting thing so far?
I think, the way we've built the story, so far in India. So, I mean, I think you will be aware of that, right? I mean, Indians have not really been used to working out and actually giving, fitness a top priority. Mm-hmm. Even today, if you ask, friends in India, how many of you all work out, right? I think that number would be about 2 on 10, is my guess, right? And I think the kind of numbers that we've been now doing in terms of, users booking trials, purchasing memberships, it's really fulfilling to see that we've actually helped people, kickstart their fitness journey. We are consumers who say that, if it was not fraternity, I wouldn't have discovered that I love Zumba and mm-hmm. I wouldn't have lost 50 kilos, mm-hmm. right? Or I wouldn't, I would have not worked out with my husband, and you know, we would have actually not taken on, you know, fitness as a journey together. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really fulfilling for me, because it's happened for the first time in India as a story, and mm-hmm. you know, fraternity is doing it, so that's exciting.
Excellent. How big is the market?
So you know, I mean, I think when you're looking at a market, you know, for a typical marketplace like a model, you know, like a fraternity, where there's a demand side and a supply side, right? So let me break it down, right? So the supply side, we're seeing on an average there are about, you know, 5,000 players in a metro city, mm-hmm. right? Which is sort of Mumbai, Delhi, Bangalore, and the others, right? Mm-hmm. So we're looking at about, you know, 60,000 players in the country, mm-hmm. Which are doing different forms of fitness, right? These are a combination of organized and unorganized players, mm-hmm. Which could be doing gym, yoga, Zumba, Pilates. With more and more exposure, we're seeing that they are growing at about 25% year on year in terms of sheer numbers, mm-hmm. Because new forms of fitness are coming in, new people are getting excited, you know, about fitness. But I think the interesting story is on the user side, right? So I remember when I started out, you know, looking at fraternity as a business model in, you know, in 2014, mm-hmm. You know, data points said that there are 4.8 million fitness consumers in the country. And recently when we closed a survey, you know, we actually, you know, figured out the number, and that number has grown to about 20 million, mm-hmm. right? So there, which are 20 million users who are keen on fitness and or have started, you know, fitness already in some form, excellent. Right? And we're actually dividing the entire market into three sectors, you know, three sections, mm-hmm. as far as consumers is concerned. Mm-hmm. There are sitters, seekers, and hunters, right? Mm-hmm. And I'll take a moment to sort of explain,
yeah,
what it means, right? Sitters are the guys who've actually never really owned a gym membership, have never really been keen on fitness in any form, will only do so if pushed by a doctor or a medical report or a loved one which says, hey, listen, get fit to live longer, right? Or to live in the first place. Mm-hmm. The other side of the spectrum are the hunters, which are the guys who don't really need motivation. Fitness is part of their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So they're the guys who run marathons, do CrossFit. Fitness for them is a way of being. Mm-hmm. They're not looking for discovery. They're looking for fulfillment. Right in the center are the seekers, yep. right? Seekers are the guys who are constantly in the lookout of one, you know, options to get fit. Mm-hmm. They're constantly struggling for, you know, 5 kilos, 10 pounds here and there, and wanting to get, you know, fit, and are pretty much yo-yoing in terms of health and lifestyle measure. Fitness for them is a pursuit, right? I mean, they're always in the pursuit of fitness. Mm-hmm. What we've realized is that, you know, why this market is increasing from, you know, a 4.8 million to a 20 million, we're talking about not just the hunter market increasing, but we're also talking about a lot of sitters moving on to seekers, mm-hmm. and the larger seeker market increasing, mm-hmm. which is a massive deal in terms of all the kind of users who are wanting to get into fitness and who already want to remain fit.
Excellent. So some questions about you then. What's your background? I believe you did an MBA, right? Is that right?
Yes, I did. So I did an MBA in human resources, mm-hmm. Went on to work with Aon Hewitt, which is world's largest HR consulting firm. Mm-hmm. Did a lot of interesting work with them in talent and op consulting space, mm-hmm. You know, for about 3 years, and which is when you know, the entrepreneurial bug hit me and I started fraternity.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so did this MBA help you, or did you have to learn everything from scratch?
Interesting question. I think something that happened about a few years back, half a decade back actually. Okay. I think looking back, I don't feel that it really gave me any kind of knowledge or any kind of you know, push in terms of skill set. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of on the job learning that got me got me to work and got me to deliver where I was supposed to deliver as a consultant, mm-hmm. right? In Aon Hewitt, mm-hmm. It did help me as far as opening up the connections, mm-hmm. Helping out, understanding what I stand for, understanding what are my strengths and what should I play on. So I knew that people management is a strength. I knew, you know, sort of big picture thinking is a strength of mine, right? Mm-hmm. And I think over the years, what's helped is knowing those strengths and then working on them and really carving out that niche in a very corporate environment, right? The ballgame is very different when you're doing a startup.
Mm-hmm. Cool. What did your parents and work colleagues think when you told them that you were going to quit your job to do your startup?
It's interesting. I think all of them while I wasn't sure what I was doing, everyone around me was like, oh, we always knew you would do this. So I think it was quite a lot of validation saying that, okay, if they think that, if all of them think that I was always meant to do this, maybe it's a good idea.
And what were the early days like? Did you have to overcome any obstacles?
I think early days were, I think, absolutely crazy. I don't remember not clocking in 15-hour work days. And I don't remember, ever taking a vacation or ever taking a weekend off, right? Mm-hmm. But that was always because of the kind of impact that we were trying to create as a company. Mm-hmm. The kind of obstacles that we face on a regular basis is first doubting whether something like this will work, mm-hmm. right? Second, figuring out a product that's going to hit consumers and that's going to hit vendors and everyone's going to be happy about it, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, biggest obstacle would be getting the team right. Mm-hmm. Because it's really the team that mm-hmm. makes, the most of difference. And I'm so happy and I actually feel very lucky that the guys who joined us in the very start are the guys who are business heads and, COOs today, and who actually, pretty much treat the business like their own. Mm-hmm. Several obstacles and obviously, team and HR being one of them. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the hiring process then. Do you ask friends or do you ask recruitment agencies? How do you go about hiring people? Or, how do you find the correct person?
So one thing that really works for Fraternity now is, applications on our website. We've had a lot of people who currently work for Fraternity who were consumers to Fraternity and went on to work with us section on the website and actually applied. That works very well. When it comes to recruitment, we have a very, very stringent policy on what we call a fraternity fit. Mm-hmm. And the fraternity fit comprises of one, someone who's a fitness enthusiast. Second, someone who's open to challenges. Mm-hmm. And three, someone who's a team player mm-hmm. and an ideas person, mm-hmm. right? So what we really do is we try and gauge these across, multiple sort of ways, right? Mm-hmm. One is an interview. Second could be like a conversation, with peers and having them just come and brainstorm with us. And third thing that's really worked for us very well, which is something that we continuously used to do in terms of hiring, is actually get people on a one-week trial. Mm-hmm. It sounds very bad, but the way it works is, let's say Neha's interested in working with Fraternity and we'll just tell her, hey, why don't you just come and experience what it is like to work with us. 1 week, we'll throw you into every sort of, department. Mm-hmm. You'll be doing live projects. You'll be shadowing everyone. Mm-hmm. And at the end of 1 week, it'll be very clear to you and to us whether we want to take this mm-hmm. forward. And it's worked brilliantly well for us.
Excellent. What's the vision of the company?
What we would like to do is we want to be, the most focused, the most, referred to brand as far as anything in fitness is concerned, mm-hmm. and really handhold both the consumer and the service provider in terms of their problems, right? So when I say this, I want Neil, who is a fitness enthusiast, to know where to get started, what to do, figure out all the options, mm-hmm. book his trials, take an informed decision, mm-hmm. And then purchase a membership. Once he's purchased a membership, enable him to ensure that he actually sticks to his fitness goals, mm-hmm. Incentivize him, give him support, motivate him, gamify his experience, and actually be there across his fitness journey. Mm-hmm. And if Neha is an owner of a studio, help her optimize, help her manage her data better, use analytics, use a CRM platform, mm-hmm. have it enabled in a way that she's actually able to manage Neil better at her studio and ensure that Neil actually renews the membership. And it results into multiple business opportunities for her. So I think that's what we intend to do across different geographies. So we would want to be a global brand doing this.
Cool. And what are you working on right now then? Anything interesting or exciting?
A couple of things actually. We're launching new categories. So like you would have seen on the website, we're focusing on options for working out, right? Mm-hmm. Which is basically gym, yoga, Zumba, Pilates, all the things that actually fall in the spectrum of getting a workout. We're now really focusing on food, which is subscribing to healthy meals, and you can actually discover it through fraternity. Third focus area for us is actually kids and sports. Mm-hmm. So we are launching that category soon. That's one. Two, we are focusing on a very, very sticky and very exciting consumer app. Mm-hmm. So while there is an app out there which helps you discover, book, and try, we're coming up with an app which actually helps you stick to your fitness journey and really gamify your experience.
Excellent. So let's talk about funding then. I believe you've raised some money. Is that right?
Yes, yeah. We have. Yes, yes.
And how can you tell us how much?
Yes. Yeah, so when we started out, fraternity, it was obviously something that I did with the savings that I had. Mm-hmm. Soon realized that we will need an angel round. So we got an angel round of about 300K from friends and family, mm-hmm. USD. Then we looked for funding in terms of growth capital to take the concept from what it was in Mumbai to actually take it to other cities, add new categories. Mm-hmm. And we secured 1 million USD as our pre-series A round of funding last year in August from Xfinity Venture Partners and Saha Fund. Mm-hmm. We've actually deployed those funds, and we're in the process of deploying those funds on the product, which is the platform in terms of mobile and web. We used it to obviously expand into other geographies and categories. And the idea is to now sort of use the remaining funds in terms of marketing, in terms of really having the word out there for fraternity as a brand. Mm-hmm.
How long did it take you to raise this money?
It took us to about 6 to 8 months from initial outreach to actually money in the bank.
Mm-hmm. And did you have to do like a lot of pitches to VCs and angels?
Yeah, I mean, we did. So we were focusing on VCs at that stage because we were looking to raise, 1 million. Mm-hmm. And definitely it involved a lot of pitches. But what we did was, in second part of our outreach, we realized that we wanted to get more focused. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to sort of reach out to VCs who we believe would be the right fit as well. And I think that really helped us. So it was massive effort for those 6 months. Mm-hmm.
And have you got any like tips on pitching for our listeners who may be doing the same process?
Absolutely. I mean, I think to begin with, use introductions and use connections well, right? Rather than just having a cold email or a cold call go out there. Figure out your linkage to that particular person you want to connect with, right? So let's say, for example, a VC firm and that this guy is, so first identify who you want to talk to, mm-hmm. right? So as fraternity, first we would look at the person who's looking at consumer internet, mm-hmm. Inside that VC firm. And second, we would want to target a hunter or a seeker, mm-hmm. right? We would not want to talk to a sitter, mm-hmm. right? Because that's base, right? So identify the right person. And once you've identified the right person, don't do a cold email or a cold LinkedIn mm-hmm. connection request. Figure out who would know him or her in your network. Figure out connection of a connection. And I think that works the best. And sometimes you actually never know who you are connecting and who you're meeting and how much, how many doors they could actually open up mm-hmm. for you. So for example, Xfinity did not happen through a cold email or through a pitch mm-hmm. at all. We actually met them through someone mm-hmm. and they said that, we see a great fit and why don't you meet Xfinity? And we also met our other VC fund over a conversation that said that, why don't you meet, so-and-so person? She's looking at investing into, women entrepreneurs. So I think really play strongly on your connections and ask for introductions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so last few questions then. What should first-time founders should be focusing on?
Definitely one, the product. Be very, very clear on what your minimum viable product should do. Big learning we've had at fraternity is that we said we will go after everything. And obviously now we're very focused on building a lean startup, right? So, from that book and pretty much that book being a Bible of sorts, step one, figure out what the minimum viable product is. Step two, just ship it out, get mm-hmm. feedback. Third, take the feedback and ship out another product, right? So don't take 6 months to develop your product, take 2 months to develop your product, and improvise till the next 6 months, right?
That's right.
So I think that's one. And two, obviously, figure out the right people, because it's the people who will actually build your business with you, because as a founder, you can only do that much, right? So it's about your core team that really makes a large difference.
Hello, Vishal. Thanks for coming on the show today. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Neil.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and what you're doing, please. Sounds interesting.
Sure. In my current role, I'm the founder and CEO of Hot Chef. It's a meal kit delivery service currently in Mumbai, in India, where we send measured ingredients, pre-proportioned ingredients, everything that is needed to prepare a particular dish, exactly measured for 2, 4, 6, and so on people. And it goes with step-by-step instructions with how to cook a recipe within 30 minutes. All our dishes are exotic, restaurant quality meals with ingredients which are seasonal, hard to find, or very expensive, which doesn't make sense procuring in bulk and then worrying about shelf life. So that's the basic premise. We are trying to make, we're trying to take the legwork out of the cooking process. And by that, I mean the menu planning, the grocery shopping, the measuring of the ingredients, and only the fun cooking part, which is the more interactive part, is what we leave to our consumers. And make the whole process really fast, fun, and easy.
Excellent. So it's like a DIY do-it-yourself type.
It is exactly, yes. Excellent. It is a DIY kit, and it's in a way cooking for dummies as well. Mm-hmm. And the end result, there's really very little margin for error. We give very detailed step-by-step instructions. You just follow them if you're a novice cook. If you're a more experienced cook, you can make some improvisations, and the end result in either case is fantastic.
So everyone loves a journey. How did yours start then?
Yes. So I used to be a banker before. I used to work on Wall Street in New York for about 10 years, advising technology companies on mergers, acquisitions, and forth. But as during my tenure as a banker, I got an opportunity to travel the world, food has always been a passion. Mm-hmm. I love food and I love cooking as well. And, there was always this thing that since I love cooking, I would try to cook at home for me and my wife. And there was always this issue of either we are buying too many ingredients which are going waste, or we are cooking way too much food just for the two of us and we're left with a lot of leftovers. And we look for services where we could only get what we really need without really spending a bomb on these expensive ingredients. And we did come across a couple of these services and were really impressed with how easy they made cooking. Back home in India, there was the whole food scene over the last 3 to 5 years has completely transformed. We have Michelin star chefs from all over the world come up and set up restaurants here. Food is something that Indians take very seriously, spend a lot of money on. Yep. And the Indian consumer has also, there's been a whole behavioral change where they've become much more experimental with their food options. Just an extension of how they've been traveling to more exotic and offbeat places. Mm-hmm. And that exposure has led to them also being more experimental with food. And finally, just the popularity of food shows like MasterChef, which is highly popular here, which led to me getting convinced that this is a great service for the Indian market. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to do something entrepreneurial after having worked in banking for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I decided to do something that I'm really passionate about. Food was the top of the list. Mm-hmm. And then decided to sort of set up this venture here back in India.
Excellent. So how long has this been going on then? And can you share some stats? How many meals have you delivered and stuff like that?
We've been about 15 months old. Yep. The first 6 months was more just educating the customer. For me, actually, just getting used to running a venture and that to a food venture, which was a completely new thing for me, working in India. So there were a lot of firsts, but the first 6 months was more about just getting used to everything, getting the operations, the logistics right. So we've had about, I would say, a little under 10 months of actual operations. And we're doing a couple thousand meals a month. And all of this without no advertising whatsoever. It's a new concept for the Indian market, and we're relying on, it's a bootstrap venture as well. So I'm investing heavily on the infrastructure and on the core product. And we're trying to do advertising and social media marketing, all that in a very smart way. But we're primarily relying on word of mouth publicity, which has worked really well for us. So, you know, we have tremendous growth in the number of customers that we are serving, the areas. Now we've started covering all over Mumbai. We started with just a few pockets of what were the places where there was a customer concentration of this kind of offering. But now we've expanded to the entire city. That we deliver our meal kits, and now we are also looking at expanding at a couple of neighboring cities.
I mean, how long did it take to get your first customers, and how did that feel?
So thankfully it was a lot of friends and family that tried out the product. So from our first day of launch, we had orders. We'd done a dry run last summer with about 75-80 people, because again, given I was away from the country for almost a decade, I wanted to ensure that this is a service that would have some value proposition for customers. I've seen it in the American mindset. I've seen it in the European context as well, where these kind of offerings have worked extremely well. But again, I wanted to just ensure that the Indian customer is ready for it. So we did a dry run with some boxes and almost 75-80 people. We sent out some boxes and took their feedback, and they loved it. So there was already, and they were just waiting for us to sort of launch full scale. But I think post three and a half months, word started really spreading. We were covered by a lot of media publications and, interviewing on the radio and things like that. I had a PR firm which does a great job in terms of finding out the right collaborations and whom to tie up with, where to get the maximum visibility out of. Early on, I also participated in a lot of food pop-ups and exhibitions where people could actually see the product firsthand, given again the newness of the concept. And that really helped in just people getting to see it and then just getting so much more confident in trying out our offering.
Interesting. I'm interested to know who your main customer is. Is it like families or students or working professionals?
Working professionals is the primary target. Again, people who've had that kind of, familiarity of international cuisines, foods of the world. They've traveled enough. And at the same time, they are stressed for time, given their working schedules and everything. So that has been the primary target customer. But having said that, we've had a lot of housewives, a lot of kids, again, given the popularity of a MasterChef Junior, who suddenly there's been this renewed interest in cooking. You know, unfortunately in India, if you rewind back to like about 7-10 years, cooking has been a taboo. But now people are again finding that they want to experiment with cooking on their own. They're not just relying on takeaways, and home cooking is to an extent the same usual, and they want a change every now and then. And that's where someone like us steps in, where we give them everything on the platter, but they still get the gratification of cooking a meal from scratch.
Cool. I mean, how big do you want to go with this? Obviously, is in Mumbai. Do you have plans to expand?
Absolutely. So as I said, we hopefully in the next couple of months should be present in at least one more city, and then a couple of areas that are on outskirts of Mumbai, but are expanding at a very fast pace. So we're looking at those areas as well. And then over the 6 to 8 months, the plan is in the next 3 years to have a pan-India presence. And, that's where this model really kicks in, because we have a state-of-the-art web interface for our customers. We develop recipes, and all we need is, these physical kitchens in 6-7 cities, which could serve the main core city, the tier one city, and a couple of tier two cities around them.
How do you keep the food fresh then?
So we have a couple of things. We have these foods grade boxes which lock the entire freshness of the ingredients. But more importantly, all our boxes go with ice gel packs that have at least a 6 to 8 hour shelf life of keeping the food fresh at room temperature. And then again, we put these boxes in thermocol boxes. So and typically these boxes reach anywhere from one point to another in Mumbai. They reach within a maximum of 4 hours. So we've never had an issue. And then once the customer refrigerates these boxes, they can be used up to 4 days.
Excellent. And how big is the team?
We are about 18 people and expanding rapidly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what do you look for when you're hiring people?
It's mainly the commitment and the dedication with which, given a startup, I personally spend a lot of time with them. Mm-hmm. You know, if I try to gauge if they have an attention to detail, you know, the Indian customer, like a lot of other customers, is extremely demanding. And given a lot of the ingredients are going raw, the one thing that I emphasize or I couldn't emphasize more with my employees is just the attention to detail and the focus on freshness and the high quality of ingredients. Mm-hmm. And then it's just the attitude, really. See, this is not a very, it's not really a white collar job. There aren't really any skills. At the end of the day, we are, For the most part of the team, we are just collecting ingredients and packing them in Ziploc bags and putting them in a box. So what really comes is the attitude, where what is typically required in a startup, that there is no job role, everything. If need be, I need to mop the floors as well. Yeah. If need be, I need to go and deliver the box as well to a customer. So that openness is something that I really look for from all my employees.
What do your friends and family think of this? Because I think, didn't you like quit your job to do this? What was their reaction?
Yeah, I mean, they were a little bit surprised, but not so surprised, just given they all quite know my passion for food. Mm-hmm. And now having, obviously, there was some sort of, a rebuttal from especially my parents, that are you sure you're giving up a very attractive Wall Street career? You're moving from New York to Mumbai. So there were a lot of things that were going in the opposite direction. But at the same time, they were very supportive. They had all their faith in me. And now, you know, my friends have been great ambassadors for me, trying to spread the word. And, you know, it's moments like these when you get appreciation from your friends and your customers that you feel that the journey is so much more exciting.
What is Wall Street like? I mean, obviously, I watched the films, read the books, but you know, what's it really like?
There is a lot of indulgence. A lot of what is shown in the movies is unfortunately true. But at the same time, I don't regret a single minute of my 10 plus years in working, because I think just the whole experience of being involved in things that make headlines on the newspaper the next day, some of the most life transforming transactions for companies, where you are advising, going in as an expert when you're a banker, or let's say you're a sales and trading guy, you have these difficult targets to meet. So there's a lot of pressure. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I have learned the most is the ability to deal with multiple deadlines and deal with pressure and just come out on top of that. It sort of prepares the confidence that I was able to leave my job and get into completely out of my comfort zone into something that I've never dealt with before was just because of the fact that I knew that I've worked on multiple deals together. I've traveled and at the same time gotten things done, and it's all possible if you have a good team. So there were some really great learnings. It also teaches you how commitment and dedication are an important part. The attention to detail. I was lucky enough to work with some really good guys who I'm still in touch with. They're great mentors from me. And the whole aspect of, Wall Street and advisory and all this has become a commodity in today's time. But the attention to detail and the philosophy that your customer or your client is the king is something that I've really learned there. And I try to imbibe a lot of that into my learnings here. And I can really see how that is setting us different at a higher level than our competition.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. You talked about learnings. What would you say is the most surprising thing about your entrepreneurial journey so far? Anything that surprised you?
I think what was difficult after having worked for 10 years in a corporate setup, and back to in the US, coming back to India, I guess it was difficult to just get adjusted to the lower levels of professionalism, unfortunately, here. And more importantly, I sort of got spoiled over the years there, where, you know, there was a printer issue. I just had to call help desk and somebody would come and fix it. Here, as an entrepreneur, you cannot more often than not afford these kind of luxuries, and you're trying to get a solution for everything indigenously. You have to do it by yourself because every penny counts. So I think the biggest learning was that how you have to be a master, a jack of all, and also getting work out of people who are at a different level. You know, when you're working in a corporate culture versus working with the blue-collared workers that I mentioned about, It's a different tack as to how to extract work from them. It's a different way how you incentivize them. How do you, you know, especially when you're working for a startup, and there are always question marks on whether things will work out or not. That's been the biggest challenge and the biggest learning as well.
Okay, let's talk about marketing, because obviously you've got the website. I mean, how do you go about marketing the website? How do you get customers to the website? Is it SEO? Is it offline? Is it
word of mouth? So we've been very heavy on social media advertising right from day one. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, so on Facebook and Instagram today, thankfully, we have tools where there could be a lot of targeted marketing, and that helped us spread the word. We would also send flyers out in newspapers to specific communities within the city where we thought our target population was. Then I said we participated in food exhibitions and pop-ups where people got to see the product. And, just word of mouth is something that has really played a big role for us. We ensured that the product that goes to the customer is really high quality one. And we've seen how they have been great ambassadors for us to help us spread the word.
Excellent. I mean, how do you decide what meals to offer?
Yeah, so a lot of it is that. That's the most exciting part about my job, because, you know, I'm like, hey, I've tried that one sandwich while I was traveling to Tokyo, and I really think we could, the Indian customers would love it. So at some instances, it is trying to change the ingredients a little bit to adapt more to the local taste. But I work with a very interesting panel of chefs here who are working in high-end restaurants. Because again, we also work globally. I have an in-house team of chefs, and every 2 weeks we have a sit down in terms of what is the seasonal produce right now. Is there a particular thing, like, let's say Brussels sprouts are in season, or fennel bulb is in season? So let's try to incorporate that in the recipe. Now, these are things that are not available across the city, and they're only the wholesale markets that are available at, there. And the equivalents of the Waitrose or the Whole Foods here are extremely expensive. Just because of the high overhead costs they have. So the penetration rate of these high-end grocery stores is very low, just because a lot of people cannot afford them. And that's what we really try to do, is incorporate those ingredients. We try to also incorporate a menu that takes into account any festival. So let's say there's a Chinese New Year, then we try to have a menu that is predominantly Asian, just to celebrate that. Now, for the monsoons, we have plans for coming up with an entire soup range that our customers are just going to relish when it's raining. So we try to take a combination of things, seasonality, any festivities going on, and more importantly, just things that I have tried or some of the team members have tried, and we try to experiment. The good thing is we have a dynamic menu. It changes every month, so it does give us the luxury of being a little experimental, that hey, we not, if our customers like it, great, otherwise, you know, we can always change it with something else, and we try to be unconventional in that space.
Yeah, what would you say is the overall vision of the company?
Yeah, I think, this is going to be a 3 to 5 year journey as a product. Meal kits get established as something regular in people's food choices. And that's the timeline that we are also looking at. We expand, we build on a brand as the premier provider of meal kits, and have a pan-India presence where we are pretty much, having presence across all the four corners of the country, and tie up with logistics partners, tie up a lot with the farmers and directly cut the middlemen and try to bring as fresh and organic produce to our end customer is basically the vision.
Cool. Obviously, there's a lot of food startups in India. How would you sort of, what would you say is your USP, or how would you stand out from the crowd?
I think just the getting a particular product. So what our USP really is, that the same restaurant quality meal can be recreated at home under 30 minutes.
Yeah.
So that satisfaction of cooking a meal from scratch, knowing that what your kids are eating is something really healthy. You've seen the quality of the raw ingredients, what's going in, which unlike a restaurant meal, you cannot get to judge that. I think that's what sets us apart. And it's only a period of time when people get used to the 30, 40 minutes of cooking. But at least, you know, also they get the opportunity to experiment with ingredients that otherwise are not easily available, or they would not have tried with those just because they don't know how to cook them. With us, they get a lot of these opportunities that, hey, you know what, I'm going to be given instructions. I just have to follow them. And if I don't like, I'm not going to be left with a box full of an exotic product that I don't know what to do with.
Excellent. Last few questions then.
Sure.
What's the startup scene like in Mumbai? I mean, do you get help and support?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially with the Prime Minister, Mr. Modi, there's a lot of impetus on startup. The investor community is extremely, you know, there's a lot of activity going on there. There's a lot of money to be invested. And there are these highs and lows where there are times when, investors get more cautious, but more often than not, the mood is extremely positive. The government has come up with a lot of rules and regulations to set up companies. They're trying to ease the whole process for startups, giving them tax incentives. And I think the one big change that I'm seeing coming back to India is that people in general are also extremely helpful. I've come across some really good mentors who are going out of their way to, they know I'm not from the industry. Mm. They don't know me from before, but during our interactions, they've offered to help me with any issues. And then there's a lot of encouragement and, that sort of support that is being provided by the industry leaders. And I think that is something that's really impressive.
Because you're bootstrapping this, and obviously there's a lot of food startups that have been funded. Mm-hmm. That obviously went bust. what's your view on that then?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been of the view that, getting investor money and sort of throwing it away on just marketing, having billboards across the city or doing newspaper ads is not really a good use of money. I firmly believe that you need to build a brand for customers to be less price sensitive, because at some point, the discounting is only going to work so much. Mm. And at the end of the day, the customers will pay a premium only if you offer a good product. And it's going to be a slightly longish journey, but one that I'm more convinced about, that, we'll make it to the end just if we focus on the core product, and if we try to incorporate our customers' feedback, what are they looking for? Trying to correct every, just giving them an end-to-end seamless experience. So, it is scary when you've seen millions of dollars being invested in some startups in 1 year from getting their third round of funding, they start shutting operations. So all that is scary. But in a way, it also reinforces the fact that, there's a particular way. You just focus on the product, focus on your customer, and everything else will follow.
Excellent. And obviously, you've probably dealt with a lot of first-time CEOs and first-time founders. I mean, what mistakes do they make that you've seen?
I guess, I'm never focused on... I guess everybody makes their own mistakes. You have to go through that journey. And I've read somewhere that you're not doing a good job as an entrepreneur if you're not making enough mistakes, which means you're not trying enough. But I guess overall, just getting too attached. The one thing I hear a lot from some of the people, some of my clients that I've worked with, is that sometimes they get too attached to their product and are difficult to, they're not too okay making changes to the core product. And that's something I keep telling me that, just keep getting customer feedback. If I think something is good, but the customers are not liking it. We need to keep changing. Mm-hmm. So I guess not being sentimentally, I mean, obviously, as an entrepreneur, you're very passionate about your offering, but at the same time, you need to take into account what your customer feedback is and try to tweak the product, as and when required.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Hey, who are your business heroes?
I've been a tech banker. So I follow a lot of people from the technology community, obviously, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, all these guys have set up great examples. And then back home here also, we have some of the best industrialists in the country who've started from nothing, be it the Ambani brothers. So there isn't really a hero per se, mm-hmm. but I've been inspired by a lot of people across the journey.
Excellent. And do you have any like favorite books or blogs you want to share with our listeners?
I love to go through a lot of cookbooks. Otto Lenghi, especially from the UK, mm-hmm. is I love his work. Especially the Nopi restaurant in Piccadilly is one of my favorites. So I go through a lot of them. The food and wine books are amazing. So these are the kind of books that I spend my time reading, trying to come up with, getting inspiration for what recipes I want to cook up.
Excellent. I just want to ask you some quick fire questions now. Mm-hmm. Are you a morning person or a night person?
I am a morning person.
Okay. Are you a coffee person or a tea person?
Tea.
Okay, cool. And what's the first thing you do when you wake up in the morning?
I have a warm glass of lemon water.
Cool. And what is on your home screen?
My wife and my kid, my recently born two-week-old kid.
Okay, cool. What's your favorite possession?
My wife. If I can call her a possession. But yeah, she's the reason I'm doing what I'm doing is all thanks to her. She's the one pushing me to go try this out. And I really owe it to her. It wasn't an easy decision.
What's your favorite meal, just out of interest?
Pizzas. I can have pizzas 365 days a year. It's that simple.
Okay. Cool. Actually, we have a lot of listeners outside India who may mm-hmm. want to visit India for some time. What can you recommend them to eat for a first time?
The street food. You don't have any inhibitions. A lot of the street food has really gotten sophisticated over the years, and we have some amazing, amazing street food that you can enjoy in a very sort of a sophisticated environment. It's all hygienic. So the vada pav, which is the equivalent of a burger. Mm-hmm. And again, the food in India, again, varies significantly as you move from one state to another, especially from the east to the west and the north to the south. So each region has its own speciality. South Indian food, again, which is getting very popular in the UK, is also something that's really great. And so it depends on what state you are, but some of the best foods is every state, every region has their version of street food. And that is something that you get to get the best flavors, the most local ingredients, and something that the locals enjoy. And what I try to do when I travel is always look at, where do the locals eat? What are the kind of staple food habits of the locals and try to get that experience, because that's how you can really know a place.
Mm-hmm. I'm the founder of ShopHop, and what we are is a curated marketplace for natural, artisanal, and homegrown foods. We're trying to provide a platform for food entrepreneurs across India, people making jams, pickles, starting their own tea brands, organic farm fresh produce. Think of us as a go-to place for discovering new brands as food entrepreneurs come up. And the way we're trying to go about doing that is by providing these entrepreneurs with a host of benefits, including marketing, branding assistance, and of course, logistics like traditional marketplaces do, so people can discover them.
So how do you come up with the original idea then?
So ShopHop is something that I started in my college years. I took a semester off from Columbia in New York to start ShopHop, which was then a hyper-local platform. And what we were trying to do is bring small local stores in Mumbai online. But it was more of a pet project, a side project, as I was going through my undergrad degree and thinking about things. And what I realized is that the homegrown food space is completely unorganized. Mm-hmm. I think for hundreds of years, you've had your local auntie or your local family friend that makes great jams and pickles, but they never really get the platform to turn it into a good brand and become well-known on a national basis. So we're trying to capture that talent because it hasn't really been done that well. And farmers markets and food exhibitions in India are still very new. So barring that and some amount of organic growth through friends and family, these people don't really have a platform to become something big, even if they have great products. So recognizing that, I think, was the first step, and being like, hey, like, we love food. We love trying new and interesting things. You know, if someone threw bacon flavored ice cream my way, I would love more people to know about it because it tastes great. So that's essentially how we decided for the new model of Shop Up.
I mean, can you share some stats? I mean, how many orders are you getting? How many sellers do you have on the platform, et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. So we started in January and we've been growing at 100% month on month. For this month, which is June, we're projecting over 300 orders this month, which is about 10 orders a day. In addition to that, we also have started serving several offices across the city for healthy snacking and bringing in better food for them as opposed to your regular chips and fried food that you get in the office spaces usually. So collectively, we have a GMV of about 2.5 to 3 lakhs this month. In Indian rupees.
Excellent. So this is like a two-sided marketplace then?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. So who actually sets the prices then? Is it you or the sellers? You know, what's the revenue model like?
Yeah, so most of our revenue is from margins that we receive on every transaction that takes place on the website. And this is this ranges from 25 to 35%, depending on the amount of logistical support that we offer these vendors. But what they're really paying for and what they're really excited about is the marketing that we're doing for them across social media, physical showcasing that we take charge of for them at farmers markets, logistical support, and of course something that we're working on now that we're excited to launch in a few weeks is data analytics and support, right? So who's buying your product and what do they like about your product, which is actually really valuable for these food entrepreneurs. So that's what they're you know, really giving us these margins for. So I mean, on every transaction between 25 to 35% is what we get, and that's the revenue model for us.
So we started in January. What were the early days like? I mean, how long did it take you to get, you know, make money, make your first order, etc.?
Yeah, so early days are fun. They can be exhausting, but they can be exhilarating in equal measure. So early days were more about finding the right kind of brands. We knew that if we start Shop Hop with run-of-the-mill brands that you can usually get in retail today or that aren't exciting, then people aren't going to associate Shop Hop with artisanal foods and natural foods. So a big part of what we've been doing and focused on even till today since January is sourcing these food entrepreneurs and convincing them of the benefits that we have to offer. Many of these people are, you know, homemade housewives, home chefs that haven't really considered how big their business could be, and having those conversations is a big part of what we were doing. And then, of course, reaching out to friends and family and telling them about the concept and saying, hey, check out Shop Hop and check out what we're trying to do. And, you know, I think you'll find some interesting foods.
I mean, how big do you want to go with this? Obviously, you're in Mumbai at the moment, potential-wise.
So we want to be huge, and I think we can be huge. We've identified 300 target brands across Mumbai alone. And with that, we're projecting a total market size that we could tap of about 1,200 to 1,300 crores in the city. And then when you expand that across the entire country, it's absolutely massive. It could be up as big as 15,000 to 20,000 crores. And what's exciting here is that this market is growing significantly. Artisanal foods is traditionally something that many people imported from foreign countries, but now with the rupee devaluing, many people have gotten into making these themselves. This can be anything from a pesto to a hummus to pita bread to, as I mentioned earlier, something interesting like bacon-flavored ice cream. And what's even more exciting is that it's not just Western flavors and Western palates. When you expand to other cities, like the smaller cities in India, there's a lot of ethnic foods that are being made in new, interesting ways. So the flavor palette can be completely different, but they can be equally exciting. So by year end, we hope to be in a position to expand into the other metro cities, which is Bangalore, Calcutta, Delhi, and Chennai, which have huge markets in their own rights. And by then, we'd have a pretty good idea of how to go about our sourcing strategy and how to build up a brand base in those cities as well.
Cool. Who do you say is your core audience then? Is it friends? Is it families, students, working professionals?
So I know the answer that entrepreneurs give you is everyone. But what we've come to realize so far the people making the food purchase decision, especially for packaged foods, since we don't do ready-to-eat meals, we do packaged foods, is mostly currently young working couples, housewives, and the expat community in India who are looking for these things and don't find them. So those are people we're targeting, but we're also targeting students in a big way, because the reason people are complacent about food currently is because it's so easily put out in front of them. They don't question it. It's a very busy lifestyle. So you come back and you eat what's on the table, or if you don't have time, you'd order from a restaurant. But we want to get people more into the cooking culture, if that makes sense, or more into the snacking culture that can be healthy for you as well. So getting students involved in cocoa butter and peanut butter and getting them interested in things like that, which they really like, but they just haven't traditionally had time to explore.
You've mentioned healthy food quite a lot. So is that, are you saying that, you know, majority of Indian people are now becoming unhealthy or becoming more healthy, do you think?
I think they want to become more healthy for sure. And that's a trend that's increasing definitely, because it's something that comes with rising disposable incomes, rising awareness, rising urbanization, and all of those things are happening. People are going to realize that, you know, as delicious as biryani is, you can't really have it every third day of the week ordering it into lunch. So I think that's a trend that's going to increase and continue, and people are going to get more involved with their food decision making as well. Traditionally, it's been the last priority for a working couple or someone who works very hard, but we want them to get more involved in it. And that's one of the reasons we're going to offices and looking at healthy snacking culture as well.
So do you actually deliver it yourself, or do you get third party delivery companies to do it for you?
In Mumbai, we deliver it ourselves, and we've seen a pretty big, pretty interesting amount of, we've got people from smaller cities like Guwahati and Mangalore across the country that are interested in these foods that have been ordering. So we have a tie-up with a third-party provider for out-of-Mumbai deliveries.
Okay, cool. How big is the team?
The team is just 5 people right now. So I'm the founder, and then I have a couple of my high school friends that joined me full-time towards the end of last year. One of them works in partnerships and sourcing. One of them works in operations. We have SEO, which is, of course, critical when you're an early-stage startup. And we have a couple of delivery staff.
Because looking at the website, I believe one of your mentors is your dad, right?
Yes. All the capital so far has come from him.
Okay.
And we're actively raising some angel rounds as well. We're attending a few pitch fests. We won a pitch fest recently held at the India Entrepreneurs Meet, which was our first pitch fest. So we're really excited.
Congratulations. Yeah. Excellent.
Thank you.
Why did you think you won then?
Well, I think that we put across a good story. I think one of the interesting things that's happening right now in Indian e-commerce is that it's evolving and maturing. So if you look at marketplaces, which traditionally start with an assortment across everything, something like what eBay is today, and Snapdeal has evolved into. Now marketplaces are looking into more interesting niche segments like Redbusted for travel. And food, just being so big, is something that hasn't really been looked at entirely. It has from the restaurant perspective and meal perspective, but not in terms of the packaged food perspective. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that excited the investors, and I think they believed in our goals and vision. So that was encouraging for us for sure. Mm-hmm.
So, Pete, we have a lot of listeners who may need to do some pitches. I mean, what advice would you give to them? Obviously, you've won the pitch to start competition.
Yeah.
Any do's and don'ts?
So I think definitely be prepared to field a lot of questions from the investors that are very highly skeptical. So, take some time with someone who is going to play devil's advocate and who perhaps doesn't believe in the idea or believe in your business at all, and try to understand where they're coming from, right? Like, what are their questions? What are their doubts? And try to have be pretty prepared for those answers, because if you have a plan in mind to address all of those risks, then it shows that you're well prepared, and I think that's the only thing that can stop you from an otherwise great pitch.
Excellent. And what are you working on right now?
Right now, we're working on one is, of course, building out investor relations, bringing the word out. Another is, of course, working on our data analytics front, which we're really excited about, because it's not something that's traditionally been explored as a value-added service to suppliers in the marketplace. But we want to look into that a lot in terms of building out the infrastructure to collect consumer data. Why do they like your peanut butter versus the peanut butter that they usually get at retail? Mm-hmm. What does that tell you about what you could potentially do as a complementary product? What it's like about your packaging? These are things that are very, very valuable to suppliers at an early stage. So that's something we're really excited about. And of course, working on TasteCase, which I'm not sure if you know about, is our subscription box.
Okay.
And we launched that in May, and it was very, very, very well received. And what it does is it curates 4 new brands every month, and it brings it to people's doorsteps in sample sizes. So you get to discover new brands every month on the first Sunday of every month. And that takes the experience of food discovery that we're trying to promote right to people's doorsteps.
Okay. Sounds interesting. There's lots of bacon-flavored ice cream in there.
Hopefully in the coming months with ice cream, you have to figure out, make sure that it's high quality with dry ice going in there to preserve the temperature. So we're working on that. But yes, we plan to send that across to people soon.
What would you say is the hardest part about this business? You know, what takes up most of your time?
Definitely making sure that quality is never breached upon. In an industry like food, as you're scaling, you have to keep a definitive system in place to make sure that every product being delivered is proof checked in some format. Of course, as you scale, that gets harder and harder to do. But keep in mind that if a single customer receives a jam that has gotten spoiled or someone gets sick, then the liability is on you, even as a marketplace, even though you're not the one manufacturing the product. And that's a huge responsibility and something that, you know, you have to think about every day.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Obviously, you had a background in investment banking, management consultant. I mean, did this help you or did you have to like start from scratch?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think I would have had the confidence at 23 to be starting and scaling my own venture unless I'd done management consulting, because what it teaches you to do is, sit in a room full of C-level management and think about business problems and business strategy and what are some of the problems that plague them. But what it really teaches you to do is break down those problems and research and come up with creative solutions. And I think once you have that skill set and you have an idea that you're passionate about, then it gels really well with entrepreneurship.
And what would you say is the overall vision of the company?
Well, we want to be the go-to platform for every single food entrepreneur in India in 3 years. We want a food entrepreneur who has a talent for cooking, any kind of food, whether that's a beverage, snack, or dessert, or organic farmers, to be like, hey, I want to be on ShopHop, and this is what's going to help me grow in a big way. And we want customers to be spending time on ShopHop the way they spend time on a Pinterest today, or the way they spend time on a Facebook today, because they want to discover new food brands. They want to learn about the people that are making them and make it a fun and immersive experience. So in 3 or 4 years, we want to be across the country and hopefully maybe even go public one day.
Excellent. Sounds exciting there. What would you say is the most surprising thing about your entrepreneurial journey so far?
That's an interesting question. I think the surprising thing is... Well, you go in with a set of hypotheses and visions, and I think it's surprising how often you have to take a step back and go back to the drawing board and question them and pivot as such. So, even with ShopHop itself, initially when I started as a hyperlocal initiative, there was a lot of passion and belief that this is a great idea. But over time, we came to learn that, bringing retail online has many challenges. So you have to go back to the drawing board and do that. So it's not as, it's very much learning as you step along the way. Mm-hmm. I think there's a famous quote, I forget who said it, but it's entrepreneurs bite off more than they can chew and then figure out how to chew it along the way. So I think that's something that I definitely underestimated when I started this. But as time has gone by, I definitely think that's also valuable. I think what excites me most is that as cliched as this sounds, we're helping people and we're creating a community, right? If you look at any great enterprise that's technology oriented, it brings people together. And, if you take a step back from the fact that it's a visual digital interface, that's pretty cool to do. It's like building a village, right? Or like if you ever played Age of Empires, you're building a community from scratch. In the future, if we have 1 million people visiting our website and interacting with home chefs and giving them feedback on their food and interacting through food and wellness, then that's a pretty amazing achievement in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. And what's been like the best-selling product so far on the website?
to? We have a few. I would definitely say one of them is called The Green Snack Company, which sells kale chips and quinoa puffs.
Okay.
So much, much healthier alternative to Lay's, but tastes incrementally better. As well as Flat Tummy's cookies, which are vegan cookies. A lot of people in India are now shifting towards the vegan trend, but they taste as good as a normal cookie, but they're vegan, which is amazing. And a bunch of our ice creams as well. They're really good. We have these traditional Bengali ice creams that are handmade, sugar-free. They're made with jaggery, so they taste great. Mm-hmm. These three definitely come to mind.
You mentioned marketing earlier. I mean, how do you sort of grow your user base? Is it like all online, or do you get, you know, is it word of mouth?
So it's definitely a bit of both. We have to be making phone calls every day to friends, to family, and to anyone that's associated with Shop Hop through any degree of connection. Of course, online is something that goes without saying. You need to grow your viewer base, and you need to have posts going out every day engaging them. And not just necessarily about products, but you want them to build a relationship with your brand. You want to be posting quirky content. You want to be posting entertaining content because people will then be more likely to want to see what you're posting about. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, print media in India is very, very valuable still. As much as social media has picked up in the last few years, I think print media has a much, much larger audience base. That happens to be more expensive, so we're going about that a little bit more slowly, being an early stage startup, but that's definitely in the plans as well.
Excellent. I was going to ask you 4 quick fire questions now.
Sure.
Are you a tea drinker or a coffee drinker?
Tea drinker.
Okay. Are you a morning person or a night person?
A night person.
And what's on your smartphone home screen?
My smartphone home screen is WhatsApp, Hype Machine, Spotify, FaceTime.
Okay, cool. And what do you do on Sunday?
Well, follow up on the English Premier League. I have a blog, which I'm starting, which is collecting music. Hoping to read some news on Manchester United changing their manager. That's about it.
Okay, cool. I hope you don't, because I support Man City.
Oh, well, so, we might still beat you to the Champions League spot, but the West Ham game was just depressing.
It was, definitely. Last few questions then. Who are your business heroes?
Business heroes. So I definitely follow Chad Dickerson a lot. I think Etsy, in a lot of ways, is an inspiration for Shop Hop because of the way that they managed to build a community and successful enterprise around what is traditionally not considered a booming business, which is handicrafts, right? They've really found a way to get artisans together and get people to appreciate their craft and the amount of work and effort that goes into what these people are making. And then, of course, I think on a more on a more general note, Steve Jobs, not just for the products, but for the design. And I think, one of the things he says is actually quoted on Shop Hop, which is that consumers don't always know what they want. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really interesting insight because you need to have, especially as an entrepreneur, you need to have the belief that what you're building and the products that you're showcasing is something consumers will love, even if they don't know it yet. Mm-hmm. So no matter how many times they might come back with skepticism, if you're confident of that and if you're capable of building out a product that you know they will love, then you're onto something.
Excellent. And so in your opinion, what should first-time founders be focusing on?
I think they should spend a lot of time testing and validating their concept. Mm-hmm. I think people have great ideas, but then executing that in the market and whether that's enough to change behaviors is something important to consider. With what Shop Hop is doing, for example, we had to think a lot about, will people want to buy foods, the kind of food that we're selling online, as opposed to buying it in retail, which is how they traditionally do it. And what we came to learn about was the fact that the reason they buy it in retail is because they trust that house that is supporting those brands for the quality. But if you bring across those brand stories and if you bring across the value behind the brands, they might be able to do it online as well.
That's the end of the show. If you liked it, please leave a rating and review of the show. Just search for The Indian Startup Show on iTunes, Stitcher, and we're now on Spotify. If you're building something exciting, please email me hello@anilpatel.co or tweet @IndianStartupShow or go to Facebook.com/IndianStartupShow. I'd love to connect. Thank you and goodbye.